It was the summer of 2018. Not so long ago really, but at the same time seems like a lifetime ago. And why not? It was a very different time. It was a time of dreams. A time of hope. A time of magic. The kind of magic that makes a mysterious, bottomless box of movies appear on a front porch, all under the guise of an ice cream company contest giveaway. And what does one do when entrusted with such a magical gift? Start a podcast, of course. And thus was born the Pop-Up Filmcast. Along with a menagerie of friends, Keith and the co-host with the most, Derek, dug deep into that fate-riddled box of films each week, reviewing some of the most amazing cinematic features ever created. Starting October 2nd, they are curating the best of those offerings into Pop-Up Filmcast Reanimated. Sure to be a delight to lifelong listeners and new fans alike. So find Pop-Up Filmcast wherever you do that, and prepare for the return of magic in the world once more.
Hello, and welcome to the Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I'm Phil Rude,
and I'm the dad.
And I'm Phil Rude,
Austin Rude, and I'm the dad.
Every week we watch a movie, and then we get on the mic and talk about it. Wait, you think this is your pick?
No, I definitely picked this one.
I'm hosting this week.
But it's... You picked last week, now it's my
week. Right, this is leading in from the... what are we doing here?
We gotta talk before we record, you know, next time.
Next time, maybe you won't skip the pre-show meeting that I put on the schedule.
Okay, you and Django on the couch is not a meeting. That's just morning coffee.
You call it what you want, I'll call it what I want.
All right.
All right, let's host this week together.
I think that's only fair. You picked The Shining for our first 2 weeks of Halloween.
Right.
And I'm very excited for our next 2 weeks where we'll be doing It.
It.
This is a nice middle ground for
us. I think so. We chose this. We did choose this one together as a I don't think we meant for it, but I think this is actually a great bridge between these two, and we're going to get into why that is.
I think we kind of just picked it because we both liked it, and right. It's like Stephen King related.
And it's Stephen King related.
And it's turning out to be like tonally perfectly in the middle for these two.
I think we couldn't have picked it better if we were trying to find the thing that bridged these two sets of movies. I don't want to call them franchises. I don't think we would have done as good.
Yeah.
But we'll get into all that.
Accidental genius aside.
I mean, we can't help it. We're that good.
That's just how we roll. That's just on the how it is. Show.
That's right.
But yes, this week we are watching another Stephen King related movie, The Black Phone. This movie follows Finn, or Finny, a young kid who loves rockets and hiding in bathroom stalls, as he falls victim to the town's notorious serial killer, the Grabber. He also encounters the spirits of previous victims that help him stay alive.
That's right. This movie stars Mason... I'm going to say Mason Thames as Finn, Madeline McGraw as Gwen, Ethan Hawke... I almost said Stephen Hawking.
Oh, God. Very different movie. Someone get on that,
you
please.
Are a naughty boy. Ethan Hawke as the Grabber. Jeremy Davies as Terrence. E. Robert Mitchell as Detective Wright. Troy Rudseal as Detective Miller. Miguel Mora as Robin. And James Ransone as Max. This movie is directed by Scott Derrickson and written by he and Robert Cargill, based on the story by Joe Hill, son of Stephen King.
Tying it back together.
Which ties it all in here together. And my first question for you is, do you think that he ever considered his pen name Joe Prince, since he's the son of a king?
I mean, that would be kind of cool. I think he kind of... maybe he should have just taken King and... But I don't know, as a son, you kind of want to, like, separate yourself from your dad.
I know. You tried to change your name when we started this podcast.
That's right.
You were like, I don't want to be labeled as a Nepo baby in the podcast world.
All the other podcasters hate me.
That's right.
I'm just a continuation of, my dad's empire.
I think Joe Hill is one of the Nepo babies who... it's hard to hate on because I think he has made his own distinct footprint in the world of writing. I think he's done his own thing. Lock and Key is something he's sort of hailed for in the comic world. You know what I mean?
Not looking at the Netflix adaption.
Please disregard the good for Joe Hill for getting paid. You know, but right. I just,
respect
boy,
it.
I really could not connect to that series. But I think Joe Hill is one of those people who has kind of carved his own path. He's doing, you know, the family business, but I think he does it very well.
Yeah, I honestly can't speak much to his writing and how it's different from his dad. I've only read a few Stephen King books and I haven't read any Joe Hill. So I really only have experience.
Lock and Key is my biggest reference point for him and this movie.
Right. You know? And I've seen like maybe the free chapter, first chapter of that online. Like I haven't actually read Lock and Key either.
I haven't read all of it. I've just read a little bit here and there. It's very good. It's it's a cool series that it's on my list of like, okay, do you ever find a comic series and you're like, there's so much of it. It's like, okay, I want to start on this, but I have to commit to going through the whole thing.
I don't have the time to unpack all of this.
All of it. And then, you know, you look into, okay, every trade paperback is going to cost me whatever. And you just kind of like, okay, I'll get to it kind of thing.
One day in the future. Yeah.
But we both have in the little over a year, this movie's been out. In wide release, I think it's listed as 2021 on IMDb, but it actually released in 2022, didn't it?
I think
that summer.
I
think there was probably
maybe
an early release or something like that, but
or maybe home video versus theater
could be. But I've seen this movie like four times.
I've seen it three times.
I've seen this movie a lot, and It's really weird. I think the first time I watched it, I was like, it's pretty good. I don't love it. And I would still say, like, I don't love this movie. But I think I like it a little bit more every time. Some of the things that I criticize, I kind of... it's a little easier to brush it off and concentrate on the parts of this movie that I really do enjoy.
I think it's a really, like... good movie to just get into. Like, it's a really good atmosphere, but it's also not like too heavy.
Yeah.
That, like, you don't feel like disgusted after watching. Well, there's parts of this movie where you feel very disgusted, but like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not
burdening you, but it's not stupid either. Like, it's, you know what I mean?
It's
like,
well thought out.
It's kind of like a really good Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon movie that you catch on, you know, TBS or something. And you're like, oh, I'll hang with this. And you just kind of go with the vibe of the movie.
You very quickly, like, get sucked into it.
It's not dumb. It's not just background noise, but it's not like, oh, you really got to pay attention and get every... you know, or you're going to be completely lost. It's not The Shining. It's not...
I mean, I feel like that's shown off in, like, the kind of twist ending that it has. Because it's not, like, a really complicated twist, but it's, like, it's effective. Like, that sequence, you know what I'm talking about? Like, where they're at the wrong house.
You're showing
the
wrong
house.
It's all... Yeah.
It's all linked together in a really creative way that, like... But it doesn't take itself too seriously or get too complicated.
It's the Silence of the Lambs ending is basically
yeah
that. I think it's been used in a couple other movies, but it it does make sense when you get down to like, oh, this is the burial spot, the killing location is somewhere else.
But that's where the ghosts kind of are, so yeah. That's why she's being called to this house.
It's, and also I think why calls are coming from the outside, like, because the bodies are in a different place.
Right.
But there's not, like, a lot of clues leading up to that. You know what I mean? It's not like this, the breadcrumbs were there all the time. It's not Fight Club. It's not anything like that.
And it's not trying to be. It's, just a very simple, like, effective third act that, like, rounds this movie out. Like, it does its job really well.
I think this movie is really good at just being a suspenseful thriller. But also putting, like, just this weird supernatural angle into it that doesn't dominate the movie. It's not the scary part of the movie.
It doesn't feel like a ghost movie.
Right. The ghosts aren't the scary part.
They're the heroes, kind of.
Right. The flesh and blood person is the monster. And, you know, which is, I think, the really cool twist on this, where, oh no, the ghosts are, you know, it's like Casper. You know, it's something like that, but
it's like they're scary. Like there's jump scares, but it's like it's just kind of body horror. It's like, look at what's been done to them. They aren't themselves anymore. They've been abused
and they're forgetting what they're like to be alive. You know, all of these kinds of
losing touch with their past.
Right.
Kind of self.
Their kind of ego is fading, you know, like.
It's sad.
Yeah, no, I think it's real sad, and I think it's I think the way they actually get that sense of loss in there is by having two of the victims be somebody that Finn has a connection to and that we've seen in the movie.
Mm-hmm. They're not all like nameless, like
right.
Or show up after the fact.
Oh, like, you're the paper boy. You're this person. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just people that you've heard of. But like when, you know, Robin is the one who stays with him, you know, or stays with himself the longest. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, partially because he's the latest victim, but also just because he has that strong connection to Finn.
That whole like first act where they build that up is really good. I think, at least.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think Bruce, the other victim that he...
From the baseball...
From the base, the field. Asian kid who hits the home run off of him. I like that because there's this sort of sense of him kind of trash-talking as he's running the bases. Mm-hmm. But then he gets to the end and he's like, you know, your arm is mint. And he's like, compliments him at the same time, and it's like, oh, they could have easily gone to the trope of like, oh, this is my baseball rival and he's a dick, but they're like, oh no, he's cool.
Yeah,
like they both just play for different teams and they both just love baseball and competing,
but there is also that sense of like they do start as this movie opens with them as like opposing forces.
They're on opposing teams,
but it isn't like mean.
It's not personal, right. It's not, you know, like they're just competing, and I like that because it does also establish that as much of a kind of cowardly kid that Finn is, and I don't mean that in a bad way because I don't think the movie means it in a bad way, that he is a competitor, that he is, you know, he's not afraid to compete in a sport. He's not afraid to exist in the world.
Yeah, they show him as like kind of timid. Like he has this journey that he goes on, but he doesn't start out as like afraid of everything. Like
he's afraid of people. He's afraid of bullies. Mm-hmm. He's afraid of his dad.
He's afraid to stand up for himself.
Yes. But there's a weird arc to it where it's like, he's afraid to stand up for himself until he's not, because there's the implication is like, you've never been afraid of it or you've never been unable to, kind of thing. You've just been afraid to try.
He's been given, like, the opportunity, I right. guess.
He's also been beaten down his whole life.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what... I feel like there's two evils in this movie. There's the dad, and there's Ethan Hawke's character.
Right.
And I feel like, in the beginning, he's just, like... He's used to it. He's used to his dad. He's used to this life and, like, right. being afraid of, like, speaking to people. And then he goes through, like, an even worse horror. And after that, it's, like, no big deal. Like,
I can deal with my drunk dad. No problem. Yeah. There is a correlation between that, between the bullies that he's running away from constantly. Mm-hmm. And the, I think you see this big difference in him and Gwen, how they each handle it. Like, mm-hmm. Gwen stands up to their dad, even as he's like beating her ass.
When she breaks like the vodka bottle.
Yeah.
And
Gwen stands up to the bullies who are beating up her older brother. And I think. Maybe kills one of them. I mean,
it's a little unclear, but it's definitely
definitely gave him some head trauma.
I hate any like kind of yeah. just like bleeding from the head. I'm like, no.
When you see him dazed and then it's trickling squirting, down, yeah. it's like, oh, she really. I think she might have killed that kid.
We don't see him the rest of the movie.
No, we don't. I do like that as. Then she gets kicked and she just goes and sits by him on the fence.
Yeah.
It's like being tagged out in dodgeball or something.
She's
like
I'm
that.
Done now.
Okay, we're out. And yep. they're just sitting there bleeding. It's like, this is weird.
It's kind of a funny scene.
A little bit. But it's also like another Stephen King connection is like psychotic children. Like these children brutally, mercilessly beat each other.
I'm like, beginning to think that the 70s and 80s were just, like, this horrific time
it's
where, like...
outrageously violent.
Did all teenagers carry switchblades?
Right.
Were they all, like, did half of them die? I don't know.
You know, there's...
The way these movies painted.
We talk about Stephen King and his 1950s bullies, even when things are taking place in the 70s, 80s. A lot of his bullies are like 50s greasers. We're going to talk about that with It next week. I know.
That'll be a big topic.
You know, as newer adaptations of Stephen King move the time period up, mm-hmm. the archetype of these bullies never gets updated. So they stay as like these 50s kids with switchblades.
I want to see, like, modern day, like, cyber bullies, but they're like these greaser kind of
right.
bullies. Like,
this one does do the thing of being a period piece. Like, this is a late 70s, and I think that's partly because the phone is so central in this. I think the idea of having a serial killer or a serial kidnapper. It happens a lot less now because they're caught. People are caught. It's harder to get away with a crime long term.
Right.
And this is supposed to be like a John Wayne Gacy type of serial killer. Apparently in the Joe Hill story, the grabber is a clown, just like John Wayne Gacy was like a birthday party clown.
Which he kind of, I mean,
right.
they have that in this movie a little bit.
I think the studio thought because it was on the heels of It, they're like, too many clowns, too many Stephen right. King-related scary clowns.
Gotta make it your own
And
somehow.
They made him like a magician instead, which I think super works with, and we'll get into the masks
better, yeah.
and stuff, that and how much I like that. But yeah, like it was this idea of a time also, because I grew up in the 80s, and kidnapping was a super real fear of kids in the 80s. I remember being terrified of being kidnapped when I was a kid.
They had, like, the kids on lunchboxes and stuff.
Kids
like...
on the milk carton. There was a girl who was not far from the town I grew up in, and she was kidnapped, and you just would hear about these things, and the news was always about kidnapped kids.
So it makes everyone a little uneasy.
And it was like this very, very terrifying kind of time. And there was like a lot of latchkey kids for the first time in the 70s and 80s. You know, kids were left on their own. Like, that's the thing I like about in this movie is there's a serial kidnapper in this town, and Gwen is out riding her bicycle by herself at night. It's sort of like, oh my God, this is the worst.
I mean, the police are visiting the school like every month.
Right.
But they're not like telling them, here are these precautions. Here's the curfew.
There's no curfew. There's no martial law kind of.
They're just like, we lost another one. Sorry, guys.
That is kind of what the time felt like with it. It's like, oh yeah, everybody's afraid, but yeah, there's not much we can do.
We're not going to do anything about it. Yeah.
You and I did talk when we were watching the movie about, like, these cops have done absolutely nothing to solve this case.
No, a 9-year-old girl solves it for them.
A 9-year-old girl with...
The Shine.
I think so. Should we talk about it?
Yeah, I 100% believe that this is within the Stephen King universe.
Sure.
It fits everything.
They're in Colorado, just like the Overlook Hotel. In 1978, the events of The Shining take place in 79, 80. I think The Shine was really strong in Colorado right about this time.
Oh, no. So this is an echo.
Geography aside, I think there is definitely the idea that Finn has The Shining, Gwen has The Shining. Their mom had The Shining, and it drove her insane, apparently.
Right, she had the bad Shining, right. Essentially, and tuned into the negative side.
And the Grabber has The Shining.
Right.
Just like Jack Torrance is drowning it out or denying it. You know, mm-hmm. Like, they said he can hear it too, but he pretends he can't. Which I think is just such a great, great touch and rings so true to what we know of The Shining.
Yeah. I think that also kind of speaks to, like, there's this kind of, like, immature quality that the Grabber has. Like, I feel like, I don't know, obviously he's a monster. Like, that
right.
much is clear.
Yeah.
But, like, there's something, like, sick and twisted with him inside, clearly. Like, it feels like he's a child on the inside. That he, like, he has the Shine and he can, like, hear the phone, but he's ignoring it. And, like, there's also the way he kills his brother, and then he's like, look at what you made me do. Like, he's right. blaming other people. Like, it's this very childish
it's a tantrum kind of thing. Denying his responsibility for it. Sort of trying to get his way. I think the idea that he is living outside of society in some way, like, he's just sort of like, oh, yeah, I just do what I want to. I kidnap and murder children. Like, right. it is this idea of, like, just like a child.
It's like he feels entitled to
the mentality of a child in an adult who can actually do things, mm-hmm. is, like, the terrifying thing, right?
And he's targeting all of these, supposedly, the strong kids in town. Like, you notice, like, he goes after all of the bullies, all of the tough kids. Like, he's trying to be tougher than them.
I had not noticed that, but mostly, yeah, I would say...
Maybe that doesn't fit all the way
Bruce
through.
Is maybe not a bully, but he's, like, a strong athlete.
And he got the home run, and then right after that, like, you know...
And the paper boy... Who is apparently sort of a nod to an actual famous kidnapped kid case in, like, Kansas City, of a boy who was delivering papers and then disappeared.
I didn't know that.
It's all according to, like, IMDb trivia. Take it for what it for the source. But no, that's a really good point, especially like that juvenile delinquent pinball kid.
Yeah.
Who's like basically an adult, you know, like a 30-year-old man.
He was held back eight times.
A Peter Frampton wig. But yeah, he
reminds me a lot of the bully from Stranger Things. I can't remember his name right now. Billy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The mullet. Yeah. He's so ridiculous.
Max's older brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he looks like just a full-grown man.
He's like, lifting weights and smoking Marlboro Reds. And it's absolutely. But yeah, there's something to that, I think, of the tantrum. Not a clown, but, oh, I'm a magician. You know, these kind of, mm-hmm. I'm not knocking it, but like, that's like a children's birthday party thing. There is a childish element to that profession.
Which is kind of where you get horror is like, to take innocent stuff like that and twist it.
The idea of twisting childish things is definitely like a real horror thing. Look at those fucking Annabelle movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about a doll.
Dolls are scary now.
Ooh, scary doll. You know, it's like, yeah, we all saw Chucky. Nobody was scared. You know?
I was terrified.
But yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. And I do like the magician bent on it. Like the weird, he has like the top hat. And at one point he has like a cape on when he takes Robin.
Oh, I didn't notice a cape.
You see him kind of like out of focus in the background. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And then he gets out of the van and there's like this big kind of shapeless flowing.
Billowing.
And it's like, oh, what a great effect, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and then I do love how they do those first couple abductions where you see the van.
But you don't see the full thing until
it fades out and it just is ominous, you know?
Yeah. I like how they keep it kind of a mystery until, like,
yeah,
Finn's time. And then it's like, then they show the whole thing and how he's doing this.
What did you think of the psychic visions that Gwen had and the way they were shot and pieced together?
I like them. I think they're kind of trippy and, like, just surreal enough that, like...
Yeah.
Because sometimes you wouldn't realize it was one of her visions until the end when she wakes up and it gets, you know, kind of weirder towards the end. But it starts out as like a normal flashback scene.
Right.
I kind of liked that style to it.
I like the weird filter. We talked about like the opening credits.
Well, I compared it to like the Godzilla movies.
Godzilla. They do that intro. What was your other one for that?
The Walking Dead.
Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Just a sort of like grainy, quick cut, weird audio running through it. But that's what Gwen's visions were shot in a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Is that same style. And I really liked it because they would just be sort of like fragments of visions. Mm-hmm. And,
but, like, she's getting ideas in her head,
right.
But she's not seeing the full picture.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good way to do it, and I especially liked, I can't remember his name, but we were just talking about him, the pinball kid.
Yeah.
Like, that is a normal flashback until he's getting arrested, and then Gwen is in the cop car with him.
Yeah, she, like, just kind of... First, she's the observer, like us, and then she walks into the dream.
Yeah. And then, like, Finn's voice is coming through the police radio, and the pinball kid is talking back to him, and it's the same conversation that we saw them having early, and it's
so it's
sort
like
of
she's
like,
tuning in and
it's
listening
so
to this.
It's so great. I love the way those, like, two or three scenes are pieced together to form the whole picture, and we're seeing it from Finn's perspective, and then we're seeing it from Gwen's perspective.
And then he also tells Gwen the house number, right? He says like 17.
He carves it on
or something.
He carves
he
it
does,
on the
yeah.
the guy's arm. It's so good the way it's done in such an abstract way, I think.
Mm-hmm. My one minor nitpick is every time I see that scene, I think, like, they should have made all of the writing in the scene the letter, the numbers for the house. So, like, when they go to the cop car, I feel like it should say the house number on the car.
I noticed that the cop car number was, like, 400 or something like that. I'm like, it should be the same number.
Right, it's a random number. Like, get it out of the scene or make it relevant.
It would be, like, the numbers from Lost. Like,
how they keep showing
the lottery
up.
Numbers that keep showing up and everything. And
it's a minor detail. I'm just more like, if I made this movie, I would throw that in
there. I'm right there with you. I think it would be just something to kind of... I mean, by the time he's carved it into somebody's arm, we know it's a significant number.
We get it,
You know, like, it's...
We don't need it to be hammered home. I'm just, like, stylistic choice.
No, but that's what I'm saying. Like, to do it on the cop car, to do it everywhere else in the scene, it's not hammering it home. But, like, by the time it's carved in there, it's not a secret anymore that this is a significant number. So lean in and just put it everywhere.
Right.
Because this is Gwen's vision, and I feel like... that would make sense for it to be that way.
It's relevant to her understanding it.
By the way, I love that actress who plays Gwen.
She's really good.
I love Gwen in this movie. I think she's a great character. I don't normally like the foul-mouthed kid who's just that way because, ooh, it's shocking to hear a child swear. But everything about her character is like, I take no shit. I'm not scared of cops. Like, I stand up for myself, and I know who I am. I have psychic visions, and I own that. Like, everything about her is it's precocious. It's everything that I normally wouldn't like in a child character. But I think I really attribute a lot of it to this actor, this actress.
She pulls it off really well.
She's really, really good. And I think her character is... she's just entertaining. I think she's really charismatic. And she owns all of her scenes. She kind of, like, steals a lot of this movie, I think.
Yeah, the spotlight always winds its way back to her somehow.
Her name is Madeline McGraw. And I think she's on, like, some Disney Channel show. She's in a few other things, but I thought she was really, really good.
You're right that, like, that is kind of a trope of the foul-mouthed kid, but I feel like there's so much more to her within that. Like when she's like begging Jesus to help, like,
oh yeah,
and what the fuck, Jesus?
She does the thing that I think that's a thing that though you kind of get away with it because like who hasn't felt that way? Who hasn't had somebody, a family member or friend go through some like terrible shit, and that's when you're like, seriously? Like, you know,
it's 100% right. Relatable.
I think so. I think there's a lot of just little things like that that you're like, yeah, I get that. I've been there. The swearing girl that I think, and this is not a dig against the show. I like the show. But The Last of Us, Ellie in that, I like that actress. I loved her in Game of Thrones. I think she's super talented. I think the dialogue of just having her drop F-bombs left, right, and center because it's going to shock you. It feels so gratuitous. Like, aren't you shocked by what this young girl is saying? And just... I always feel like in that show, I'm not bothered by it. I'm not some prude about it. I'm like, this just feels like they're trying so hard to shock me.
I'm going to take a moment here and try not to.
It's not a dig against the show. I really, really like the show.
No, I hear your point. I see how it might come off that way. I just disagree.
Okay.
I think that's more of like her being naive and like her character is trying to prove herself by using a bunch of curse words, and it comes off as childish and trying to prove
it's
yourself.
Super fair, yes.
That's my interpretation.
No. But there's a wide berth of how they portray that character that where that does make sense. Where she is trying to come off as like tough all the time, but then when she actually has to kill somebody,
She's not.
You see it, like, take a toll on her.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, no.
Whereas if I forget her name now, but if the sister if Gwen was in that situation, she's gonna
like we said, I think Gwen maybe did kill somebody in this movie. I think
if the grabber took her, this movie would be over.
This movie would be quicker. Like 10 minutes long. Yeah. But I, in line with great performances, I think Ethan Hawke is amazing in this movie.
He's very unnerving. Like, I don't like looking at him in this movie. Like, he gives me the creeps.
I think that's the whole point, right?
Exactly. I'm complimenting him.
I love it. And he does the thing that so many actors don't want to do is he hides his face for most of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a whole cinematic universe full of superheroes who take their masks off because contractually they will not hide their face
they want to show
from the camera.
To be fair, if I was playing a child predator, I would kind of want to hide my face most of the time. I don't think you want
maybe
to
that is it. Maybe
known
that is,
for that role. Yeah.
I think Ethan Hawke is a really interesting actor. I think he's had a really interesting career to go from a child actor and be kind of lost in Hollywood for a long time and then kind of take control of his career in making interesting choices like this.
I don't know much about his career, so I didn't know all that.
Yeah, he was like in a child actor in like the 80s. And then as he got older, because he was kind of this hipsterish, really good-looking guy, like a lot of Hollywood wouldn't take him seriously. It was this pretty boy. It was this Brad Pitt wannabe. Who is this guy? Why should we cast him? And he started doing a lot of indie movies and building up his cred, you know? And he did Training Day. And I think if you look at movies that Ethan Hawke chooses to do, he really makes some bold choices, and even when they don't work, he kind of is like, yeah, I stand by that choice, you know. And
I like that, though, when an actor like kind of experiments and is constantly trying to push into new. It's like Daniel Radcliffe kind of.
I think Daniel Radcliffe is another one of those people who refused to be typecast and made interesting choices. He and Emma Watson.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You got it right. Yeah.
Always,
you doubted yourself.
No,
but
no,
you
no.
Had the
there's
right name
there. Who's the? There's another
Emma Stone.
No, not Emma Stone. There's somebody else that I always mix up her name with. Another. I'll think of it later. But yeah,
Hermione Granger. That's.
I think you hit the wall. People talk about actors who get typecast, and it's like the actors who avoid typecasting are ones who go out and stop chasing the money and start making interesting choices and putting the work in to establish their credibility.
It's kind of what I think acting is all about.
I think so. You know, I think Robert Downey Jr. didn't have to play Iron Man for 20 years because if you look at the indie films that guy did, and not even indie films, non-franchise stuff like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, he was doing like crazy interesting work for a long time. When, you know,
it's true.
He was making his comeback before Iron Man, and then, you know, just...
But also think of it this way. He could have easily retired after doing like...
Oh, sure.
The MCU and never have done anything after that, but he's continuing to... to look
going
for new avenues.
Back and doing other things, yeah. But Ethan Hawke, I think, again, IMDb, trivia, take it for what you will. He didn't want to do this. He didn't want to do horror in general. But he did the first Purge movie, I know. And then he did another movie, I think, with this writer-director team, Derrickson.
And the Purge has a mask in it as well.
It does, yeah.
He wears a mask in that movie.
Yeah, those Purge masks were everywhere for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Remember we did that corn maze? And it was, like, Purge-themed? Everybody had those Purge masks on?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe in his contract, it's like, if he does a horror movie, he has to wear a mask.
Mask-related. Apparently they tried to talk him in, you know, we play the bad guy in this horror movie, and he wasn't sure he wanted to do it, and they asked him to read the script, and then he left a voicemail agreeing to do it in the Grabber voice. Which was like, he read the script and loved it and was like, yes, let's
do this.
That's
a cool way to accept a job.
I love it. And they were like, yes, like, this will work.
I'll take it. And also, here's my character voice.
Here's my voice. Yeah, I love that he does the voice. And then I love that he drops the voice when he's, like, yelling at his brother.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's
there's
just
a few moments where he drops the voice, right, and it's like, ooh,
it's even scarier.
It is like, ooh, he's a normal person.
Yes.
Speaking of that, there's this really, like, there's this moment where you can see on, like, Max's face, when he's, like, going down into the basement,
uh-huh,
and you can, like, see, like, he's like, what's down there? It, like, he's connecting the dots, but then he's like, no, I don't want to think that.
His coked up brain is running too fast, yeah.
It is, but there's this horrific moment where you see him be like, I don't want to think my brother's capable of that, but I have to check.
Right.
And then he does, and it's so awful to see that on someone's face.
It's
creepy.
I mean, that's the whole thing of, like, hearing the real voice come through, is that the scariest part of all of this is all of these monsters are out just walking around in the world. You know,
you can see the Grabber walking down the street. You want to know him.
You know, like John Wayne Gacy was a respected member of his community to a certain degree. You know, he's a birthday party clown and a small business owner. And like these kind of, like a construction guy, like just a regular guy. And he was an absolute monster.
That's the horrible thing about
it. Yeah, that's the real terrifying part when you get down. I think that's part of the true crime fascination is, you know, learning who these people are and how they hid in plain sight for so long. And just, yep. I think that really blows people away.
I did have a thought that if this was set in the modern day time period, that the brother Max would be a true crime podcaster.
Yes.
And he'd be having his podcast about
the Grabber. It would absolutely be that, yes. Oh, will you come in, cops, and be on my podcast and tell us about the investigation? He's got his mic set up in the kitchen.
Oh, God.
The masks. I do want to talk about the masks.
Yeah.
Because
there's a few different ones, aren't there?
Yeah. There's one that smiles, and there's one that frowns when he's angry. He's wearing that one. And there's one point where he's asking Finn what his name is, and his face is in shadow. And then when Finn lies to him, and he kind of throws his tantrum, he steps out of the shadow, and the big frown mask
is visible.
On.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, he knew he was gonna lie to him, and it's just sort of like this idea of how scary is he going to be coming out of the shadow. I think it's a great, great moment.
I didn't even really, like, fully pick on, like, I felt it, but I didn't,
right,
like, look into, like, oh, the mask is like that. Like, the mask just kind of was a thing in the movie. Like, I didn't pay much attention,
right,
to it.
But it is a projection, like, when he brings him food the first time, and he's, oh, come on. You know, eat. I wouldn't do anything to you. And he's wearing the smile mask.
Right. And there's times where he's covering his eyes.
Half the mask comes up, right.
Jaw or vice versa. It's
unnerving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those masks are designed by Tom Savini, who is a big sort of like legendary special effects makeup guy.
Right.
He worked with George Romero on, like, the Living Dead movies. Not the very first one, but, like the Day of the Dead or Dawn of the Dead kind of 70s era.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
He worked in a couple of the Friday the 13th movies.
Like the first one? Or first one didn't even have the mask, though.
Right? No, it didn't have that, but it did have effects to it. He probably worked on Frog Boy Jason, you know, at the very end when Jason comes out of the lake. And then probably some of the effect shots, like the Kevin Bacon getting the arrow through the, you know, that. So sure. He did all the, like, creature effects, special effects. He's done stunt work. If you've ever seen From Dusk Till Dawn, he is the guy. He is the guy who has the dick and balls gun come out of his belt buckle. I think his name is Sex Machine.
I haven't seen this movie, so you saying that is just like
it is
of nowhere.
Well, that's how it is in the movie. It's okay. So out of nowhere, but it's brilliant.
It's
if
a
you
really
see it,
fun cameo.
You'll never forget it. He's a stunt performer and has worked in a bunch of movies. And I love that for as legendary as he is, Blumhouse, I know they have a reputation, but they're a smaller studio. I know there's not the money involved to work with them mm-hmm. than other studios have. And that they still got someone the caliber of Tom Savini to work on these masks that are absolutely terrifying. I think that's one of the big stars of this movie and why this is so effective and why the Grabber is so effective is those masks. I think they're just amazing.
Probably, yeah. Like, I didn't think about it much, but, like, it would kind of fall a little flat if the mask was just, like, some shitty, dollar store
right.
mask or something that they had just, like, oh, we don't have the budget for it. So
like
they
the Michael Myers, William Shatner mask,
Yeah,
I mean,
like there's nothing there.
It's good. It's effective. It's become iconic over time, but it's really just a blank slate mask, which was the point.
Is anyone can be under
it. Be under it. Same with the Jason Voorhees hockey mask and stuff like that. But this is just, it's not Freddy Krueger. It's not a horrible, disfiguring, scarred face. It's also more than just hiding his face in shadow. It is a mask intended to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Intended to scare the shit out of these kids that he steals. But it's just designed so well. The way it works with the light, with the shadows that are cast by it.
Mm-hmm. When he's sleeping in
Oh my God. That is so disturbingly scary.
That whole sneaking through the house sequence. I'm just like, ooh, like it's the scariest thing ever. And it's like, it's not like a scene where like dinosaurs are chasing you or whatever. Right. It's like, it's so much more effective. Cause it's just like, you gotta be quiet.
It's a brilliantly made sequence. And then I get so mad that Finn just runs down the street. I get so mad every time I watch. I'm like, cut through a yard.
He's such a smart kid. You would think he would know better.
I follow the rules. I take crosswalks and sidewalks. I'll never jaywalk.
He reaches an intersection and
just
hits
stands
the button.
Waiting for the light to change. Yeah, that would be great. But yeah, I love the masks in this movie so much. And I think it's sort of that character of the Grabber is a combination of, I think, Ethan Hawke just doing amazing acting mm-hmm. with his body, with his voice, nothing in his face, and those masks. I think there's just those two work together and really make what could have fallen completely flat. Make it super, super effective. They made another clown right after watching 4 hours of It movies. Would anyone have been afraid of that clown or talked about, oh, scary clown again,
Probably not.
I can't imagine how they would make a clown scary again. It sounds like a
Well, it's just
that sounds
a rehashing,
like
.
The worst Trump slogan, make a clown scary again.
God. It was scary enough the first time around.
Yeah, it is a scary clown right there. Yeah. But, I think it was a great choice to change it up like that, to get Tom Savini, to get Ethan Hawke, to get these great people on board to build this really scary villain.
Yeah, I think... It also relates to the character because he's like taking on a persona or like hiding a part of himself. Like, there's, at the very end, he gets the mask knocked off, and he's horrified. He's, like, covering his face, frantic, and...
He's like, you know, like, I'm in the basement, I have to have my mask on, kind of thing.
Yeah, like, it's this weird thing.
Yeah, no, it's really, I really like that. Because
it shows what it means to him, kind of.
Yes.
It's part of what he's doing.
I think that was a great touch, and it showed the importance of those masks. Not just to him, just to the whole crime that he's committing, you know? Yeah. I also just want to shout this out as a period piece. We talked about it a little bit earlier.
That's fair. This is a lot like my time in the 70s was. It's identical to my childhood.
I will say, I did used to watch emergency reruns.
That transition was so cool, though. Phone shot to the emergency.
Emergency, yeah. I like that they drop stuff in there. Like, Finn watching it's a movie called The Tingler.
I wondered what movie that was.
Yeah, it's a Vincent Price movie, apparently. I've never seen it. But him watching that is, I think... It's a great reference. It's from, like, the 50s. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's this idea that Finn's dad doesn't let him watch intense stuff. You know, like, they talk about how he wants to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But he's like, my dad won't let me.
Yeah.
Or someday I'll get to watch a Bruce Lee movie when it's on TV or something. But, like, Finn's dad is passed out. And so he's able to, you know... watch, and you know, this also like a callback to the 70s and 80s where like the late night movie was a thing, and it would be like Svengoolie style movies of like old stuff, old horror, old classic movies. Mm-hmm. It was for like staying up late and watching a movie, you know.
What I find really funny is this isn't the first movie that's done this thing where like a young character is watching a movie, falls asleep, and then wakes up and it's like broadcast over, you know, that
right.
that thing that doesn't happen anymore. That's also in Poltergeist, and you guys had to explain it to me as a kid. I was like, why are they...
Yeah.
What is this?
What, did something happen to the TV station? No. Yeah. They just stopped broadcasting at a certain point.
But my generation kind of has their own version of that, because I've seen several memes where kids who had TVs in their room. I did not have a TV in my room. My parents wouldn't let me.
You poor deprived child.
I know. But kids with TVs in their room would fall asleep to, like, Nickelodeon, and then Nick at Night would come on.
Oh.
And so they'd wake up to,
to Roseanne.
I can't remember the name of the show. It's like, George Lopez?
Oh.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
I know who George Lopez
is. Yeah, he had a show on Nick at Night, and, like, so... kids would wake up to that show.
His
and
that's sitcom?
Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That'd be horrible to wake
up
to.
It's this whole nostalgia thing that, like, thousands of people my age have. And, like, there's a bunch of memes about
it. There's a weird thing I've noticed from Nick at Night, because Nick at Night probably started in the 90s sometime. Mm. And then they were showing, like, I Love Lucy and the Dick Van Dyke Show and all these really, really old sitcoms. And then, like, people younger than me, for them, Nick at Night is all the stuff from when I was in high school. So people are like, oh yeah, I watch Full House on Nick at Night. I'm like, what?
Like, yeah, that is what it was, essentially.
So, like, there's a nostalgia in people your age for things that are originally from my age group's childhood. Yep. It's just like, you're nostalgic for somebody else's childhood because Nickelodeon served it up to you again. Like, it's a really, really strange thing.
It's a cyclical kind of thing. One day my kids will have a nostalgia for One Direction or something.
Right, because it'll come around, or something inspired by that will come around.
Mm-hmm.
There's
I wish I grew up in that time.
There's a lot of talk in the last few years about the 30-year nostalgia cycle. Like, the idea that, and on the topic of it came out in the 80s, the book, and the kid part, the Losers Club, takes place in the 50s. It was this 30-year nostalgia. And then Stranger Things came out like 30 years after the 80s, or started coming out 30 years after the 80s.
So it's always looking so 30 years
It was
back.
Always this 30-year nostalgia cycle that gets kids going, oh, this music, what is it? You know, like the Kate Bush thing from Stranger Things.
That's a really good example, where
people ran to record stores and bought Kate Bush albums for the first time in
She became a bestseller.
She went back on the charts and things like that. Rishi B does the Oldies Mingle, and he did an episode called, it was like the Hollywood Bump or something like that, about songs that got a boost from being in a movie.
That's a cool thing because that happens a lot.
And it does happen a lot. And he, one of the things he talked about was the Kate Bush thing. And another one I know he talked about on there was Tina Turner, who was in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome and had a song on that soundtrack. And that that gave like her second wave of career kind of
like
blew
a
up
whole new set
partly
of
out of that. Right. She had this huge comeback in the 80s. And part of the help of that was being on a soundtrack of a popular movie, you know?
I think sometimes our nostalgia, as far as like media goes, can be like detrimental, because then we just get like really bad stuff that only exists for nostalgia. Like Netflix tried making a 90s period drama sci-fi thing. I can't even remember the name of it because it was so like one and done, and just like it was just references to things.
We're so nostalgia driven right now in the mainstream movie, you know, remakes and legacy sequels and things like that.
Constantly looking,
and it's gotten to be just empty content. You know, not to sound like the curmudgeon.
No, it does. It turns into an echo of an echo of an echo.
Right.
But I do like when there's stuff like that, like just kind of older stuff being brought out and like, let's admire this again.
Or something that can be a bright spot in that is dropping a song from that, you know, like a soundtrack from a movie like this can be really good, full of 70s songs that I grew up listening to, but you probably didn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And another one, like Stranger Things, not Stranger Things. Jeez, I get them all mixed up now. Super 8.
Oh.
Same kind of thing where like My Sharona and these songs I remember like, yeah,
right. That's where I know that song. I don't know that song.
That's what
else.
I'm saying. Like when you guys were younger.
We love that.
You would
that
talk
song,
about
yeah.
that and that ELO song on there, you know, Don't Bring Me Down and
yeah.
and stuff like that. And this this movie has some, you know, you got like Free Ride and stuff like Fox on the Run and stuff like that.
I don't remember a single song in this movie.
Really?
I'm trying to think, is it in the background of something?
Yeah,
is it like
they're in there? There's one right after the baseball game, they play Free Ride.
I guess I was more focused on like the impending doom sure. soundtrack that kind of dominates most of this movie.
Yeah, it's definitely in there. But to bring it back to this movie and the nostalgia, I like that this movie is not sitting there making a ton of 70s references. It's not like, hey, remember rotary dial phones? It's just like, no, the phone is an integral part of this plot.
Yeah.
It's not there so you can wink and go, I remember when I had a phone on my wall. It's like, yeah, we all did in the 70s. And it just is like, that's taking place here. The kid's playing pinball because it's the 70s. That's what you would be doing. There weren't like big arcades full of video games.
No, I think it's the perfect period piece because it's just there.
Yeah,
it's like it's just set in costume decoration. That's pretty much it, and then it's mostly background stuff. I'm able to ignore it because
right.
I don't relate to these experiences that they're kind of showing, but like I still relate to the characters, so I can just follow it like a right. normal story. You know, I don't feel like I'm missing out on something because I don't have nostalgia for that era.
Right. It's set dressing, not the focus.
Yes, it's not the story.
Right. It's not that 70s show that is just all 70s references.
Right.
It's
and now like, that 90s show. Another 30-year
that's exactly right.
Cycle.
It was a 20-year, but yeah, it's right in that pocket. Maybe it is a 20-year cycle.
It's 30 years. We're 30 years from the 90s, Dad.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. We're in the 20s now, and yeah. add 10.
And there's, let's see, Happy Days came out in the 70s. It took place in the 50s. So it is, it's like 20 to 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, and then you've got stuff like Mad Men. That doesn't totally line
no,
up.
No, Mad Men went...
It's going a little
early
further back.
60s. It's a, in the third 30-year decade when it started coming out. It was like 06, 07, somewhere in there. So it's right in that pocket, yeah. But again, okay. that's another one that is just sort of like, hey, we're showing these things, and we may be winking a little bit, but mostly this is all set dressing.
Right.
Except for the parts that were... The only things that they, like, really leaned on is, isn't this fucked up? Isn't this fucked right. up that...
Like, commenting
that,
on the
like,
culture
right,
of the time.
Like, you would just, like, openly sexually harass your secretary for no reason, right. you know? And then that it would just be Ooh. Commonplace. Or that you would smoke in your car with your kids after having a few drinks and driving them around. You know, like, just this...
Of course.
This bizarre culture of 60s professional suburbia, you know? But this one is really good. The fashion is just there. That's just what they're wearing. You know, they're watching like Davy and Goliath on TV, but they're not pointing at the TV. It's just on in the background. I really, really like the way they do the period piece here because it all just feels natural. You can be watching a movie from the late 70s. You know,
it does feel natural.
Yeah.
That's a good term for it. And it's also not like... Scratch that. I lost that thought.
Okay.
I had it, and then it drifted away.
It's not like Stranger Things.
Family Guy. No, it's
Let
not.
Me name
I'm not
all
comparing
the
it to anything. It's, here it is. It's like, I think it's just for convenience. I think it's for, like, because the story has to take place in the 70s.
Sure.
Otherwise, you know, cell phones would exist, serial killers aren't as big of a... I mean, it's still a thing, but it's treated differently.
The latchkey kid component is treated a little bit differently. The self-parenting, you know, Gen Xer kids, but...
So this story really wouldn't work in a modern setting. It kind of just had to be in the 70s as a necessity.
I think there's more and more filmmakers who are looking at, I'm going to put my movie... in the 70s, in the 80s, in something to take the cell phone out of the equation.
Right.
That would solve all the problems.
Yeah.
You know, like, and
because so many film nitpickers are like, why didn't they call the police?
Just call the, right. And
shut up.
It is just sort of like, look, we're just going to take this out of the equation and it's going to take place in the 70s now.
That's right. We're not in danger anymore. Now that you own a cell phone.
Which I don't think is a bad thing. I like period pieces when they're done. When they're done well. You know, when they're not just reference machines or nostalgia machines. So I don't hate it, you know.
I don't think it's a bad option. It definitely, it works.
I like movies from the 70s. And I think that's another thing people are looking. There's a lot of people going back and watching movies from the 70s. Because they're just made differently. Like we talked about Jaws. They look different. They're shot different. There's
they
different attitudes
different.
About everything. And I think that people are liking to go back. Partly because of nostalgia. But also because these movies are just interesting. And I think it's kind of leading people to want to make movies that take place in this time. You know, even if they're not making them as interesting. I think there's something about that.
I think... what's going to be funny is we're going to have a wave of filmmakers like my age, mm-hmm. 10 years down the line, who are going to be making like movies that are their fantasies of the 80s. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
That's not even nostalgia. That's like one step separated.
It would be like me making a movie that takes place in the 50s. It would be all wrong. It would be
exactly
just like this sort of romanticized view of what that time period
was. It's like
was.
Practically a 80s themed alien planet right. at that point. Like,
right. Yeah, no, I think that's a real thing too. And I think you can kind of tell that sometimes when people
are writing what they don't know.
Like, you weren't there and you don't really know. Sometimes it doesn't matter, but
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's weird.
I don't think I would write about a time period I don't know, because I'd be so afraid to like just get something wrong. Like,
you would have to have people working with you that, like, you know,
scientific
could really,
advisors.
Yeah, like, right. The last point I want to make is about Robin, because I think Robin's a really interesting character.
Yeah, go for it.
Robin reminds me of a character from another movie that we talked about, and that is a Stephen King related movie. He reminds me of Teddy from Stand By Me. The Corey Feldman character.
Yeah, he's like kind of protective and
he's outrageously violent and maybe a little psychotic or unbalanced. He's very proud of his veteran father. Remember, Teddy's dad stormed the beach in Normandy, and
yeah.
Robin talks about his dad who didn't come back from Vietnam, and he sort of romanticizes that about, oh, he didn't come back from Vietnam because he was looking out for his friends over there.
And that's like, what I'm doing here.
And that's yeah. what that drives him. He very much values his friends and his friendships. He's very protective of his friends. There's just a lot of parallels there. And he's probably also like, maybe not from the best home, you know,
it's never shown, but kind of implied.
He seems
here.
A little less parented than some kids, you know, like, or
what gave that away? Him being introduced by beating a child to death.
And, you know, the fact that he's a lot, I don't think watching violent rated R movies is like the hallmark of horrible parenting, but it just seems like he's kind of free range children kind of yep. thing. He's walking around town by himself. Oh, going to the store to get some stuff. Yeah, he's very, very independent
just
kind
doing
of
his
kid.
Own thing.
Yeah. But I thought he was another one like Bruce at the beginning, where they could have taken it to, oh, Robin's this terrifying thug, or a real like meathead kind of mm-hmm. no personality. And the reality is like, he's really nice. Like, he's really nice to Finn.
Yeah.
And he actually, outside of just protecting him, is trying to help Finn stand up for himself. I like that aspect of him, that he's a protector, not just like, I'll keep the bullies off of you forever, but he's trying to encourage, like, you have to step up.
You gotta have to do this on your own.
Forgive the probably dated expression, but like, you have to be a man. You have to step right. up. It's basically, you have to be a grown up, you know, take up for yourself and stand up for yourself. And that he's encouraging him without like putting him down. I don't know. I just find Robin just this really, really interestingly written character. He's like a wise old man and also a thug kid at the same time.
He is. He's like encouraging him like, hey, you got to do this. But then at the same time, he feels vulnerable enough to be like, hey, can you help me with my math homework?
Right.
Like, so they're kind of helping each other out in a way.
Yeah, I like that he's like, can you come by and help me figure out the math? And he is even like saying, he's not like holding, hey, I helped you out with bullies, help me out with math. He's just saying like, he talks too fast in class. I can't keep up. You make it make sense to me. He's actually doing a thing that, like, we understand now is, like, all kids learn differently. Which in the 70s, like, did not exist.
You're just a bad student.
And we will suspend you for getting too many Fs.
That's right. ADHD didn't exist until the 2000s. And before that.
There's no autism. There is no no spectrum.
You're just a bad learner.
You're just really lost. I like all these memes that are like, my grandma says... autism didn't exist until now. And I said, yeah, that's right. It's completely normal to put a bunch of plates up on your wall. all these things that are calling people out are like, yeah, you people are all on the spectrum.
Yeah, my dad's obsession with World War II planes has nothing to do with
being on the spectrum.
It's not trains, so who knows?
That's right. But there's just something I think this movie does really well. Robert Cargill is, I think, a really good writer in terms of fleshing things out. These two worked on at least the first Doctor Strange movie. Apparently they left the one Sam Raimi did. Doctor Strange.
The Multiverse of Madness.
That one, yeah. Apparently they were supposed to do that and they left that project over creative differences because Marvel wants indie directors as long as they don't do indie director things. This is the movie they made instead. So win-win, right?
That's a pretty solid win.
I think they flesh out these characters really well. And I think it probably, I would imagine some of it stems from source material. I'm not trying to sell Joe Hill short. I just haven't read the story.
Right. We're speaking about the movie
here. I'm just talking about the movie because that's all I know. But I really am impressed that this movie, which is only an hour and a half long, we're talking about some characters who aren't in the movie for very long, actually get fleshed out really well. Bruce, we see a flashback of like all of Bruce's life leading up to...
Yeah, like his whole childhood.
Yeah, his childhood is this great, you know, encouraging family, it looks like, and he loves baseball his whole life. That's right. You know, so you do feel it when something horrible happens to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see, like, Finn kind of upset when he sees, like, the flyer up, you know? When it's like,
yeah, it's like a grim reminder.
And he's like, the Yamadas are putting flyers up. These are new. Mm-hmm. They're putting them up again. And everybody kind of knows what's coming. When Robin gets taken and Gwen says, I'm sorry, I know he was your friend. He's like, don't say was, you know, mm-hmm. and he's doing the same thing that he's saying the Yamadas shouldn't be hoping anymore, but he's doing the same thing. And it's just sort of like, yeah, they're made to feel like real people, like real victims of this horrible monster.
Jumping off of that,
please.
I agree, but I'm going to sidestep because I think there's one character who isn't written well, and that's the dad.
I have
a bone to pick. You'll here, not get and I
any argument
it.
From me on this. Yes.
So, first half of the movie, he's like the villain. He's like awful. Obviously,
he really is like, awful. Yeah,
he's just terrible. And then they try to do. I get what they're going for here. It worked a little bit better on rewatch, but even still, it's like, ugh.
They take him too far in the first act.
Exactly. And then in the middle, they want to have this scene where he sits down with his daughter and we find out that his wife had The Shining and it drove her crazy and she killed herself. And he's just this traumatized PTSD. That's why he's so mean to his kids. But you can't have him be a complete soulless monster in the
first
half.
You can actually, like, if you want to talk about abusive, there are parents who are very abusive to their children who also can have a very nurturing side to them sometimes. And there's all of this.
And
but
also trying to do it out of protecting the child. Or There can be some justification.
This character is not nuanced enough to do that across the board. They make him 100% irredeemable in the first act, and then try to they spend the rest of the movie trying to redeem him. And it's just like, you already turned us against him.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are you trying to say with this character?
Right.
Like, it baffles me a little bit. However, at the end, I did kind of like, my interpretation of the end scene this time was different from the other times where I thought the kids were kind of like accepting his apology. On this rewatch, I kind of read it as like, they're above him. Like, they don't really say, "It's okay, Dad." They just kind of leave him as is and hug each other.
Yeah.
Which to me kind of reads as like, oh yeah, he's sorry, but we're not going to forgive him just yet. Like, he's not off the hook.
I think there's that through a couple points in the movie. There's one point right before Finn gets taken, actually. Where Gwen says, "I'm gonna go to my friend's house," because when you grow up in an abusive home, you start to basically live at your other friend's place. You know, you have
an escape, yeah.
You have those extra kids. You know, you have like, I mean, you talk about That 70s Show, the most interesting thing I think That 70s Show ever did was the stuff with Hyde going to live with the Mormons.
Moving in with them because he had abuse at home, yeah.
Because he was neglected and living on, you know, and just sort of like this family
bad
taking him in.
Yeah.
But when she says, "I'm going to stay at my friend's house," he goes, "Okay, I'll take care of Dad tonight." It is like these kids have assumed the role of caretaker to their father, who they are also in fear of.
Yep. It reminds me kind of Shameless. Like, Frank Gallagher is very much like...
Yeah.
He's just a drunk. He's not abusive in this
no,
way.
No, but he's an irresponsible drunk.
Yeah.
And the kids have learned to raise themselves.
And have to raise him, too.
Yes.
It's a sad situation.
If you've ever seen it in real time, it's very sad. It's not... You're right. I think it's too wide of a gap between what they want. They want him to have some redemption in this.
I
feel like they try to get it when he's like, "Okay, you're having dreams. I'll drive you around."
Yes.
And I like that. I kind of wish at the very end he would have just been like, there would have been some sort of conversation or indication that he accepted that having a psychic gift doesn't have to be a bad thing, because that's what supposedly has driven all of his horrible behavior.
Right.
But it just, yeah, it's just not there.
I get what they're going for. It doesn't quite work.
No.
Like, there could be some empathy there, but I...
but, yeah.
Come on.
Watching him beat the shit out of his kids for the first 20 minutes of this movie is just like, I can't go with this guy.
No,
yeah. I don't think he's written very well. He's very one-dimensional, even though they try to
give
him
that. He's acted well.
Fine, but in what we mentioned earlier in this Stephen King series, and what I know we're going to talk about more next week, the caricature of the abusive father, that it is a Stephen King staple, basically. And it is here, and it's very seldom fleshed out real well. The abusive parent. It's
one note.
Often very one note and one dimensional and almost cartoonish. And that's just what it is. You know, it's for me, that's not the important part of this movie. That character only exists to really give exposition about what happened to their mom.
And where these kids are coming from.
Right, kind of self-parenting children. These are independent kids.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a... I would say that's the exception. When I was talking about being well-rounded out, I was talking about, like, of the kids, of what we see of the kids. We actually know and actually form a connection to them with much less screen time than we get with the dad.
And I agree with you. I think everything else in the movie is so well written. It's done
really, really well.
And like, yeah. They take every moment and they find ways to build upon it and just like one-off lines. Like, I love that. But they don't do that with the dad. It's just a little weird.
It is. No, I get it. I get where you're coming from with it.
But
That's a fair nitpick. This movie is not above nitpicking. Like
it's not a perfect movie, but I do really enjoy it.
A really enjoyable movie, and I think it's been a great addition to drop right in the middle here.
And our little Stephen King sandwich.
Our Stephen King Joe Hill sandwich. We have the connection to The Shining with the obvious Shining.
That's right. And this kind of feels like, I mean, story of abuse, story of overcoming demons and ghosts, and
the story of a child in a raincoat being terrified by ghosts.
This is true.
At the very end, when she's in the raincoat and she sees the ghosts in front of the house, it is like Georgie.
Yeah,
it's straight up Georgie movie.
It's the same rainfall. They don't want you to know that. It's the exact same rainfall.
Down the street, Georgie's being dragged into the sewer.
You see the boats just go by.
That would have been the best Easter egg in the world.
Oh, what a missed opportunity.
Oh, man, you guys missed out big time.
I'm going to edit that scene later.
That would be great. But yeah, you got anything else on this one?
I don't think so. I think we covered what we wanted to cover on this middle ground.
This midpoint of October for us. Good. I'm glad we did this one. I really, yeah. I'm glad we were like, wow, what goes in between these series? Let's bring this one. This was a good call. I loved watching it again. And breaking it down, this is the thing that doesn't get talked about a lot when you do a movie podcast, is you can really have a tendency to only watch movies for your podcast. And this is a movie that we've mentioned it a bunch on here, but we've just sort of independently enjoyed this movie for
watched it a few times.
Because we just like the movie, and this was the first time I've really sat down and taken notes and kind of broken it down and analyzed it a little bit, and I feel like I have a better overall grasp on this movie.
I think this is the first time we've watched it together too, which is kind
we
of
saw
funny.
I saw it in the theater for the first time. You and I saw went to the theater and watched it.
That's right. I'd seen it before then, and then I think you watched it independently, that was your second,
and then I watched it again, and then a couple months ago, your mom told me she hadn't seen it. And she really liked it too. So we sat down and watched it. Yeah, I've watched this movie a lot.
This is our fun family movie that we all kind of is. We all get together every year and watch it.
But yeah, that is Black Phone. Please watch this because it's made by really great people.
It's a really good piece of art.
If you haven't seen it, it is, you know, I remember when it was in theaters, it actually kind of was beating out a lot of franchises. It was the top non-franchise movie in the country for
a few weeks. People were talking about it.
It was getting some buzz, and it was great to see a non-remake, non-sequel, you know, independent, for all intents and purposes. It's Blumhouse, you know, compared to Disney and Time Warner, independent movie, small budget movie, getting that much attention. And I think I want to see more of that.
I think it helped that I'm pretty sure this released in like June, or it was like summer.
Yeah, it was a summer. It was a summer release. Yeah.
So it didn't have to battle out all of the, like, you know, Exorcist 5 remake.
No,
or whatever.
It wasn't coming out at the standard horror movie release time. But it was coming out in the sea of summer blockbusters and holding its own, which is really, really impressive when you think about
that
it.
That is true.
Just like a few weeks ago, I mean, it was end of summer, but we went and saw Exorcist 3, or not Exorcist 3, Equalizer 3, which is, I mean, based on a 80s TV show, starring 70-year-old Denzel Washington just kicking ass. And that movie, like, was top of the box office for a couple weeks. We couldn't believe how crowded the theater was. We're like, this isn't a Marvel movie. We thought we'd be the only one seeing Equalizer 3. And it's just, I'd like to see these kind of smaller movies or these mid-budget movies, you know, making some waves. I think people want that. I mean, that is a sequel. It is a small franchise, sure, but it's not a Marvel movie.
It's not Barbie.
Yeah, right. You know. Oppenheimer and Barbie also like this yeah. summer. I mean, I'm loving that people are wanting different things. I think audiences are starting to
people
go like
bored and craving yes, better movies.
I think I love that we cross your fingers. Love to see a return to more kinds of movies getting put into theaters and audiences being excited about those.
Now, if you're a movie executive, I fear what you just heard us say was, we want a Black Phone 2, a Black yes. Phone 3,
Equalizer
a Black Phone 4
coming next year.
That is not what we're saying.
No, not at all. But I've gone on this tirade many, many episodes. But no, I think that this is one of those movies that kind of gave us some hope for that, you know?
Yeah. So, it's a good time.
Do check it out, and let's move on to shoutouts.
Shouting some stuff out. What do you got, Dad?
I am connecting our sets of movies with another YouTube video. This is a short one from an account I had never heard of before. I just kind of stumbled on it. It's called CZ's World. And the name of the video is, Does the Losers Club Have the Shining? And it
interesting question.
It makes a case for, and this is book related. He's covering the book It.
Okay, and, but before you say anything,
okay,
my guess, Beverly has The Shining.
He makes a case that several members of the Losers Club do have The Shining, based on book passages, based on things like, you know, Bill had a feeling about something. What I don't remember all the specific examples of them, but it is just based on sort of book passages that indicate, yes, there is a element of The Shining that runs through the Losers Club.
I have a feeling with Stephen King, he would have picked out specific characters that he thinks has, and then drop little hints in the verbiage.
But also, I think there's a lot to do with the idea of a monster that feeds on fear. Something being fear or psychic energy related is in the realm of The Shining.
It's amplifying.
It is like, that's what the hotel is all about, is amping up fear to take the psychic energy, and then Dr. Sleep again, like,
and if you are afraid and you have The Shining, you're giving off more
right
fear. It's a more powerful, it's a tastier snack for sure. It
yeah, I think so. That's a cool but idea. Anyway, it's just a short little video, and I chose it specifically because it links the two franchises. Give it a watch, see what you think. And come back and listen to us. We'll get into that. What do you got?
Well, I'm shouting out a YouTube video as well. It's a short little kind of poetic video titled The Hottest and the Coldest Place in the Universe. And quick spoiler alert, both of those are Earth. it kind of goes into it's a bit existential, but it's Hank Green talking about our place in the universe, and just it's very poetic, and I liked that video, so I wanted to shout it out.
I think that's interesting. You bring a lot of Hank Green videos to the show.
I do. It might be because that's not mostly a criticism. What I watch.
But I think it's cool that, you know, I think everybody should have a YouTuber or somebody who makes interesting video or essay content that they can grab onto, that they can constantly go to and be like, okay, let me. It's like having an author or a writer or a philosopher that you gel with. You just know you can go to them and kind of get a workout with your mind.
Well, I really like the brothers. They're the Vlog Brothers. I like them just because I feel like they start interesting conversations. It's like a... I don't want to sound like pretentious here, but like I feel like they've built a community of people who kind of try to think more intellectually about certain things, like questions of where we exist in the universe, and
I think those are always
and philosophy.
I think combined. Those are always good questions, just not even to come up with definite answers to, but if they make you think about them,
and, right? It's starting the conversation is what they do really well.
It's yeah, no, that's cool.
Yeah, so check them out.
I will check them out, and I need to check them out more. I have watched Hank Green videos before, but not a lot. So, right. Yeah. Anyway. That's shout-outs. On that note, we're going to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. And if you want to find another way to help us grow the show, you could tell a friend about us. Give them a call.
Yes.
You don't even need to have a working phone to do it.
That's right. No, no service to that phone. No problem if you have The Shining.
That's right. Or T-Mobile. No, I'm just kidding. Not sponsored.
Not sponsored.
But yeah, tell your friends about our show, please.
Us, it's your pick next week. We're getting into your series of movies, your two picks. What are we watching? We've already talked about it 100 times.
We've spoiled this review, but this reveal. But yes, we're going to be watching It, Chapter 1.
Chapter 1. This
from,
is
2018 or so.
Something like that. Around there. Yes, the newer ones. The Skarsgård.
That's right.
Pennywise, not Tim Curry. Not the 90s miniseries. We're watching these, and I'm really, really looking forward to them. I love the first one. The second one, I am due for a revisit. I remember being lukewarm about it, but yeah. I'm looking forward to watching them together, because I don't think I've ever watched them straight back to back.
I know I haven't.
So and this is going to be really fun.
I really was into It when it first came out, and after I saw the second movie twice in theaters, and then I haven't touched it since. So it's kind of faded a little bit, and I want to see how it holds up.
Right.
I've given it some time to breathe, and
same.
Now it's time to watch the whole story together.
That's right where I am, too. I think I watched the part one last year, but didn't I think that movie sits really well on its own, and then part two is kind of the addendum, and I'm the same way. I'm not dragging negative baggage in and being like, I didn't like this very much the first time. I'm going in going, I hope I see these together and see them as one big, great movie now. So I'm open to all possibilities.
I'm looking forward to
really looking forward to this.
Halloween season, baby.
That's right. That's right. We're taking it to Halloween.
Oh yeah.
With It 1 and 2. How do people get a hold of us, Oz?
Yeah, they can email us at, we have an email, it's Austin, I'm blanking on it, sorry, it's austinandphil@gmail.com, and just check in our inbox, it is still,
Still empty,
but,
I have the black email, where I get emails from ghosts.
Oh, okay,
They're the ghosts of podcasts that have faded away and
only had
updating.
A few episodes. Yes.
It's real tragic there.
But they're speaking to us from beyond.
That's right. They're helping us out.
But yes, you can hit us up at our email and just let us know what you think of the show.
Please
what
do.
We should review or what you've liked that we've reviewed.
Let us know what you think of Black Phone.
Oh, yeah.
Or what your favorite Stephen King or Stephen King related movie is.
Everyone has their own.
Everybody does have one. You can also find us on Letterboxd. We each have our own individual accounts. Austin's is Austin N. Rude, and I am Phil Rude. We both keep lists of what we're watching. I have a list of everything we've watched for the show. And I currently am tracking things on my Halloween list.
Nice.
So everything I'm watching for Halloween this year.
I know you've watched more than just the show on this month.
Yeah, I'm trying to get some Halloween. I'm still watching some non-Halloween related movies sometimes, but I'm enjoying those too. But yeah, I do like to concentrate on scary movies. I revisited a Tim Burton movie that I love, Sleepy Hollow. It's a great Halloween watch, I think.
I walked in on you watching
spooky,
it.
Spooky, but not scary. There's a great dark tone to that movie that's also a lot of fun, and I think that's what Halloween is all about.
I haven't seen that since it was, like, new, and I remember you liking it.
I recommend it, yeah.
So just from what I saw this morning, you watching it, it kind of unlocks something of, I'm like, I want to revisit that.
There's
like,
witchiness, there's spooky vibes. A weird sort of spooky folk tales, and
people dying.
Just a lot of Tim Burton, old school Tim Burton, goth kind of imagery, you know?
Yeah.
It's that good stuff. Yeah, I really liked it.
King of Halloween, Tim Burton.
Yeah, one time, maybe, yeah. On the Letterboxd thing, you got a Letterboxd review for this?
I do. This one's an interesting one because I disagree with the rating this person gave the movie, but I do like his comment. This is Thomas, who gives The Black Phone 2 stars and says, not to be a cinema sins guy or anything, but you're telling me kids in this small town are being kidnapped and murdered every few weeks and no one has caught on to the giant black van circling the school that says abracadabra on the side. I like this movie a lot, but that is a small nitpick that I'm like, he's a little obvious about it.
There, I did have that thought when the cops are raiding the wrong house and across the street is the black van parked right outside the other house. Yes. I don't think that makes you a cinema sins guy, because that's not that annoying of a nitpick. I don't like cinema sins.
I don't either. But I don't like to nitpick movies in general, but this was a detail that I...
That's a valid gripe, but I do agree. That rating is a little bit low.
2 stars, come on, man.
Just for that?
There were actually a lot of people who didn't vibe with this movie I saw, and I don't know what they're on, but...
I don't get it, man.
I don't subscribe to that belief.
That's right.
What about you? What was your top comment?
My comment that is, it's short and sweet. It's from a reviewer named Josie. They gave The Black Phone 3.5 stars and said, the grabber is a Swifty.
Elaboration?
There is none.
Okay.
I thought it was funny. And I was like, yeah, I can see that. There's
okay. In the van, like, jamming out. Yes. Black Phone, Taylor's version.
Taylor's version, that's right. She comes out on stage wearing one of the masks.
God.
Anyway, that's our Letterboxd reviews. Check them out. There's always good ones. There's always some very clever, funny reviewers on there.
And always someone who does not know what they're talking
about. Always someone who doesn't get it, yeah. And then there are people who leave, like, full essays.
Yep. Yeah, kind of like those recipes that go on forever. Talking about like their personal connection to
the history of this dish. And yeah,
it's like, come on, guys, let's take it down a notch.
The J. Peterman catalog. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week. Come back and watch it with us next week the next 2 weeks.
If you're feeling not scared.
That's right. That's right. If this movie didn't scare you, come back and watch it.
We'll see how you feel then.
That's right. Austin, do you want to read the credits?
Yeah, we do it all ourselves here on The Picture Show.
We sure do. And there you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.